so Reggie had to go. Since then, things hadn't exactly been smooth for either of them. Jackson claimed to be shocked by the deal, and decided that if the game was going to play Reggie, Reggie would play the game right back. Free agency awaited at season's end, but he wanted to get paid now. He demanded multiple years, at premium prices, before he'd so much as consider reporting to the Orioles. "Reggie, we need you," pleaded General Manager Hank Peters. "We traded for you because we think we can win the World Series with you. Come play baseball, and we will work out the money." But by then, Reggie was on a beach in Hawaii, and Baltimore was hosting the Red Sox in the season opener. The slugger eventually settled for $200,000 to play out the year. He reported a month late, missed his new team's first 16 games, then batted .208 over the next 34. That was where things stood when the Orioles arrived in Chicago for a late spring series, their preseason championship aspirations having given way to the second-worst record in the American League. Jackson, frustrated and confused, was getting booed by his own team's fans. When the Orioles pulled into Comiskey Park, he was further confused by the message that showed up in the visitors' clubhouse. It was from Finley. Finley, the guy who didn't so much as offer a token note of thanks after trading Reggie away. No sad to see you go? No nothing. They hadn't spoken since. Reggie was indignant, but his ex-boss beckoned, so Reggie went. Finley was based in Chicago. The vast remove from Oakland was one reason for his impotence when it came to building hometown support for the A's, and Jackson met him in Grant Park, across the street from the South Michigan Avenue insurance headquarters of Charles O. Finley & Company. They found a bench among the office workers enjoying bagged lunches in the springtime sun. Finley placed his Kelly Green, double-breasted sports coat, the one he wore so prominently during the A's championship runs, across his lap. His tie was undone, and his sleeves rolled up on a warm and windy day. When Finley crossed his legs, Jackson spotted a familiar hole in the sole of his upraised shoe. The owner of the A's got right to the point. "I still owe you $45,000 on your original contract," he said, "and I want you to know that I haven't forgotten it. I've talked to your people, and some of the papers have gotten lost, but I'll make good on the money because I owe it to you." Jackson didn't even remember the money. For years, Finley went out of his way to make investments on behalf of his favorite players, a kindness that, in the days before player agents and financial advisors, was an incredible boon. His standard offer was an unbeatable money-back guarantee. He'd return it all, even if the investments tanked. More frequently, of course, players would as much as double their outlay, but that seemed like eons ago, long before Finley eliminated such benefits, as his relationship with players grew increasingly antagonistic. The man Jackson found himself sitting next to was not the same one who so exactingly governed throughout his time in Oakland. Gone were the bluster and the grandiosity, the untarnished conviction that everything in the world would be better if only Finley himself was in charge. There they were, the young star and the old man, reminiscing on a park bench about times past, as if their heyday together had occurred in a different era instead of only 8 months earlier. In Jackson, Finley saw a manifestation of the times, somebody who had outgrown Oakland just as the very structure of baseball had outgrown Oakland's owner. He had summoned Jackson under the pretext of money. Did they even have a personal relationship anymore? But he wanted to see his former player for reasons unrelated to finances. Jackson thanked him for his fiscal integrity. They paused. "You doing all right in Baltimore?" Finley finally asked. "You comfortable?" The irony was impossible to miss. What Finley really wanted to hear was how much better things had been with the A's. You know, in the good old days. Jackson responded in the affirmative, said that playing for Earl Weaver was a terrific experience. That was all it took. Finley began to lament. He lamented that payrolls were growing too rich for his bank book to sustain. He lamented that baseball's new salary structure was taking his own players, the guys he signed and groomed and carefully tended, from him. They were playing out their contracts almost to a man, and before long, he'd have nobody left. Finley had put his own personal motto, "Sweat plus sacrifice equals success," to the test, and with it built one of the best teams the sport had ever known. And now he could do little more than watch as it unraveled, strand by agonizing strand. Charlie Finley had been a lonely man for many years, but perhaps was realizing it only now. After a time, the two fell silent, watching the sun filter through the elm trees all around them, listening to the breeze whistle by. After all those years, all those championships, all those words, maybe there were no words left. What, really, did they have to say? Finally, Finley tried. "We had some time, didn't we, Reggie?" "We had all of that," Jackson replied. "You're going to do all right," the older man said wistfully. Whether he was talking to Jackson or to himself was not entirely clear. What was unmistakable was that even though he was invoking the future, his mind was squarely in the past. "Every time you hit another home run, or Sal, or Joe, or Cat wins another game," he continued, "it's going to be a feather in my cap.